Today we have Dilshad Rehan, a data scientist here at Anadarko. Now, Dilshad, you're a bit newer here than some of the other guests I think that I've had so far. Can you tell a little bit about you working here? You've started recently.
Yes, and first of all, thanks for having me here, Ryan. It's a nice opportunity to actually be able to talk about my background and my work here. Yes, I started only about a month ago. I was actually an intern here last summer, and I was working on a really interesting project, and we had some really nice results coming in, and they actually were really gracious to offer me a full-time position. So I went back to grad school, completed my PhD, and I just came back and started my work.
Uh-huh. As a full-time data scientist.
As a full-time data scientist, right.
Awesome. So why don't we just jump into the project that you were... So you're continuing that project now that you were working on from back then?
Yes, yes. And that was actually one of the things that I was actually really excited about to come back mm-hmm. and work here, because I really like the work that I did. It was actually on something called geosteering. So which is like a really important part when you're actually drilling for oil wells.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working on how to, you know, applying machine learning so that mm-hmm. we can assist the geosteering process, which is right now done entirely manually mm-hmm. in the field.
Okay, so what is geosteering exactly?
Okay, so yeah, I should have clarified that. So geosteering is actually the practice of optimally placing your well inside subsurface formations, so that, you know, you can maximize the amount of oil that you can get. Because as you know, not all formations under the earth have the oil that they're looking for. And you need to place your well exactly in the right formation.
Okay. Is there usually kind of a plan as to like where you kind of know where the, let's say, payload or where the oil is sitting in advance, and you want to try to drill to that particular spot?
That is a great question. Uh-huh. So yes, normally you have the seismic data and you have some idea about how the subsurface formations are located and distributed, mm-hmm. what their boundaries are. But the biggest problem there is that you have a lot of uncertainty. So you do have some idea, but you're not really certain. But the amount of money that you're investing in drilling is like millions of dollars per day, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
So you really don't want to spend all that much capital investment and not get anything out. So how do you resolve that uncertainty? You can actually get more measurements. And that's exactly what they do. They have sensors attached to the drill bit,
mm-hmm.
and they get you those measurements. So you have that uncertainty that you have from your seismic data, or
mm-hmm.
all the uncertainty that you have before you drill. Now you're actually getting data. But remember, the sensor data is noisy, so there's also uncertainty there. So
okay.
resolving all this uncertainty and getting a refined map so that you not only know where you are located as usual, but you can also plan forward. That is the idea of geosteering.
And is it that it's usually they're trying to kind of track? So you start putting the drill into the ground,
mm-hmm.
and then you start getting the data from the drill,
yeah.
from like the end of the drill area.
Yeah.
And then you try to kind of gauge where the drill is and if that's kind of matching with what you sort of thought before.
So, yes. So what happens is that...
And then the steering, you can actually move the drill around a little bit.
Right. So we have control over where you want to drill, at what angle you want to drill, at what rate you want to drill, and all of that. And we are also getting these measurements. What they do is that, so different layers. So one layer can be like shale. Another one will be sandstone, can be limestone. These are different formations, right? These different layers have different material properties. They have radioactivity, which behaves differently.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is to get measurements of these properties, like electromagnetic properties, radioactivity levels,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and compare those with the charts of previously drilled wells.
Mm-hmm.
And based on that, they try to infer, oh, what kind of formation are you located now?
Yeah.
Also take into account the seismic map that you have. So
yeah.
based on all of these, you come to a conclusion, oh, I'm probably located at this particular place
okay.
when I have drilled this many feet into the ground.
Uh-huh.
And if I am in the right area where I want it to be, then keep on drilling in that direction without actually deviating. But if I'm
yeah.
not, then I have to make that adjustment so that I can get...
And correct me if I'm wrong. So of course, classically, the wells were all drilled strictly vertically, just straight down, right?
Right.
And so the geosteering, this is only going to be in the context, I think, of the, are they called lateral wells?
Yeah,
right?
yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So drilling in the US, so after the so-called shale revolution, has moved away from those vertical wells to more of these what we call lateral or directional wells.
Yeah.
And some of the wells, interestingly, that I'm seeing are, they have like almost 1 or 2 miles sections that are lateral. And so you need to place a well that goes laterally for that long, and you need to make sure that for 2 miles you're in the right formation.
Yeah.
That is a hard problem. That's
uh-huh.
an interesting problem.
Yeah.
So that is kind of what we're trying to solve here. So uh-huh. we need to be able to do that, and we need to be able to at least help the geosteering engineers who are actually doing that process
yeah.
right now. Yeah.
Okay, so the end goal would essentially be something like, as they're drilling the well and steering it,
mm-hmm.
that they're getting some kind of like feedback as to kind of whether they're in the right place or not?
Yes, yes. So it will tell you whether they are in the right place. It will also tell you, for example, are they cutting too close to a boundary so that they can avoid, you know, getting out of it
okay.
as they go forward.
Yeah.
It will also, also give them some idea about it, to what direction should they be drilling next so that they can
uh-huh.
maintain. Now, if they're outside, we'll obviously tell them, you know, what inputs. So it's simultaneously both an estimation and a planning problem.
Yeah, I'm wondering, how is it done currently when they're doing it? So you said it's kind of a manual process. How would you
that? So what happens is that I think every 90 or 100 feet as they drill, the sensor will send a bunch of data, like a block
mm-hmm.
of data upwards. And they have what is known as a type well. Type well is a reference well, historically drilled well that's located probably close to where they
yeah.
are trying to drill this lateral well.
Yeah.
So they use a software, and then they essentially try to match the lateral well data, the real-time data, with the different blocks, different sections of the type well. And whichever section correlates really well with it, they
uh-huh.
assume that, oh, you're probably located there. But
okay.
obviously, the problem there is that when you manually do it, the amount of data that you can actually record with the sensors that you have
uh-huh.
is actually enormous. There's no limit. You can have electromagnetic sensors that record like the resistivity or conductance. You actually have electromagnetic sensors that can actually measure properties that are not only where the drill bit is located, but 100 foot above and below.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of data that you can actually
yeah.
take in. Then you also have gamma ray data that not only can measure the gamma ray emission properties of the rock, but also in different directions or axial or so. These sensors will actually give you like 6, 7, 8, 5, 6, a lot of columns, different columns of data, like a lot of data streams, right? Now, the problem is that when you're doing it manually, you have all these data that's coming in, and you have historic data that you're trying to compare it with. It's humanly impossible. I think it's just, we're simply
yeah.
not wired to be able to make comparisons of so many streams of data and
yeah.
then come to a conclusion. That too, I mean, you probably would pick one stream and then make that conclusion and then just make adjustments using the other. That
yeah.
is simply not theoretically rigorous.
Uh-huh.
To actually do that in a mathematically rigorous way, then you simply have to rely on computers.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
That's kind of the aim of this.
Yeah, the value seems pretty clear.
Yeah.
So
definitely.
So you have some general idea of kind of where you want to end up.
Yeah.
And you're having these kind of complicated, even potentially sensors of these complicated pieces of data coming in from all these different types of sensors. And
right. Yeah.
And you're trying to kind of match up where you are exactly and steer the well into the right place.
Yep. And it's really time intensive as it stands now. I think not only will the our inferences will become more accurate as we have assistance of a digital system like this, will also become faster. So that is another thing. And the expertise that you actually need to perform this operation is actually tremendous. I've seen some of the interns actually working on this problem, and it actually takes them a lot of time. So you need 5 or 6 hours just to do a well that has been historically steered to actually redo it.
Wow.
So this is a really interesting and an important problem.
So you had mentioned a very nice story that I really liked about you being in a cupcake shop.
Yep.
Do you want to tell that story?
Definitely. So the interesting thing about problems like this is that they can be mapped into a lot of other problems that you see in engineering, different areas of engineering. And that's one thing that excites me about being an employee here too, because you have these problems that are not only domain specific, that also have mappings to other, a lot of different fields.
Yeah.
And our team here has people coming from a lot of different backgrounds because you can apply that expertise here. So the specific story that you mentioned, this is really funny because I was really stuck at one point.
Uh-huh.
And because there's a lot of noise in these data streams that are coming in.
Yeah.
And often I see, what I see is that the historic data, for example, to take a particular example, the gamma ray log,
mm-hmm.
right? So we get gamma ray information from the lateral well. We compare that with the gamma ray from a vertical well.
Mm-hmm.
And then we
the vertical is a historical,
historical well. Yeah.
So in the past, somebody did a vertical well
mm-hmm.
and they took gamma ray readings all through the rock.
Yeah. Yep.
And you're comparing it.
You're comparing it so that you can match it exactly and try to predict which rock you're in.
You're in, yeah.
So I was just stuck because this looks like there's a lot of noise and these things are at completely different scales because people use different tools to perform, to record
mm-hmm.
measurements. Like the tool that they used in the vertical well in 1980, it's not going to be the same tool that they use now in the new well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a scaling issue. There's the change of tool that can happen while drilling, which will readjust the scale again.
Uh-huh.
So, and also it's a lot of noise. I'm like, how am I...
Scale and not only... Scale, you're talking about like from like 0 to 1 scale for like the, each reading, the scale with, and then also it might be like stretched as well, right?
Yeah. And the scaling factors can also change abruptly because a tool change can happen.
Okay.
And the other issue is the noise.
Noise,
so,
yeah.
Now, when I was, so that is a central part of being able to correlate these signals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was thinking about it, and I was thinking about it sitting at a cafe next to where I was staying at the time.
A cupcake cafe.
A cupcake cafe. All right.
Yep.
A cupcake cafe. And the thing about cupcake cafe is that on weekends, these mothers will bring their children there, and there's like big families with a lot of children, and they're really loud, right?
Yeah.
It's a really interesting environment, and really exactly where you want to be if you want to get any work done. And there's this music playing in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And they're playing some nice song, and I'm thinking, and this clearly was not happening. So, I mean, my work getting done. So I just thought that, this is a nice track, and I just wanted to know what the song was. So I just pulled up my cell phone and then, you know, used Shazam to actually check what the track was. And it quickly gave me the answer. Then it struck me, how did that work out?
Yeah.
You have this noisy environment, and you have a music track playing at some amplification level compared to whatever it was stored in the Shazam's library,
mm-hmm.
but it's still able to actually give me what song it was like within 5 seconds. Like, I think that's the amount of time that they need. That just struck me. This is exactly the same kind of problem that I'm facing here. And so I was like...
Because it's just matching essentially two waves. Because if you look at the historical well vertically, that's basically like a wave.
Right, yeah.
From like start to finish each measurement.
Yep.
And then you have your... current place you're at in the well that gives you a little small reading clip, kind of a clip of the wave, maybe you can say, like a little sub part of the wave.
Yes.
And you're trying to match it back
yeah.
to that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yep. So short length of signal, noise, scaling, every single thing is taken care of by Shazam.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had to sit there and read up what they were doing.
Uh-huh.
And it was really, really interesting what they
do. Oh, is it that they go about this?
What they do is that, and I heard that a lot of people had tried it before and they all gave up because they saw that just storing the amount of information that you need to match signals, it's just billions of tracks, it just becomes impossible. But Shazam, they found a really interesting idea. They use something called a spectrogram.
Mm-hmm.
So a spectrogram is actually a 3D, three-dimensional representation of the information in a signal. So one dimension is the time. Another one is the frequency, and another one is amplitude.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're doing is that at every time, they'll pick the frequencies at which you have highest amount of energy, the maximum amplitude.
Mm-hmm.
So in every song, at certain time, at each time, you'll have some frequencies that are like really dominating.
Yeah.
So they'll pick that, and then what they do is that they reduce it to a small signature.
Yeah.
So I think this is what they call a hash map.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So they do that, and then so they create this really compressed signature for every song. And the interesting thing is that using that signature, they can really quickly search through billions of, not only can they quickly search through billions of data, billions of songs, but that signature can really encode
the
the most important information about every song.
You can actually capture everything you need to just in that small signature of it.
Small signature. Uh-huh. Yep. So even if you are getting a really small part of a song, you can still able to do you're still able to do that, and you're also able to do that really fast at scale. So that's the really interesting thing about
it. And so then you will take your little clip and you'll kind of do the same thing to it, kind of chop it down into its this is kind of, you're kind of like hashing it, sort of. This is sort of like a hash, I think you could say.
Yes.
So you kind of hash it down into a very small bit of information that still kind of fully captures what's going on, and then you check it against basically the database of all the
Exactly. So, and they patented it, I think.
Yeah,
but
it's very interesting.
It seems to work really well for them. So yeah, that's one thing that that quickly struck me. Oh, this actually matches. And there are this scaling and noisy, scaled and noisy data matching is actually, it's not just in this particular context.
Mm-hmm.
I've also seen this appearing also in a couple of other scenarios. For example, I've seen a bunch of papers about ECG signal matching. Like, you could have a new patient's ECG coming in, and you might want to try to match that with some historic signal that you have in the past.
And so this is going to be like whenever you're in the hospital, that's the little like heart fluctuation wave that you see, and like the green line fluctuating up and down for like heartbeats.
Exactly.
So there'll be some wave, and maybe there's like historical data of what these look like, and you want to kind of like match.
So because you always have a problem of signal classification that kind of come in, right?
Uh-huh.
So there, once again, this problem comes in where you have this one-dimensional signal. It can be, I think scaling may not be a huge problem there, but noise again becomes an issue. So how do you reduce it to a few, bits of information that are really important so that they can do it? So that's another place that I've seen. And a really interesting place that I've seen, another one is like vision-based navigation in computer vision, where you can have a map of a region, of an area on the earth that is, for example, loaded into your drone or a robot's memory, right? And then it has to navigate itself in an environment where it's using a camera, a digital camera, to actually capture the surroundings. And then it has to match exactly features that it has in the map with the features that it's actually perceiving in its surrounding.
Which will have potentially noise.
Which will have
and
noise.
And maybe scaled differently.
Scaled,
maybe
rotation.
Viewed at a different, rotation.
Exactly.
Viewed at a different angle.
Yes. So that is, again, a really complex problem.
Uh-huh.
Really complex problem that's in 2D or 3D. It's not even a 1D signal.
Yeah.
And there are all of these issues. And there's also the problem that what you're actually viewing is also affected by the motion, right?
Mm-hmm.
As the sensor moves, it's not getting a static image. So you have to take care of all of these issues and still be able to perform your navigation accurately.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another problem that I think is really, really close to what I'm trying
to do. Very interesting. Yeah, it's cool to see how all these, sometimes these things boil down to, noise, rotation, scaling, and then matching against something you already kind of know with those things. It's kind of cool how they all tie into that. Okay, so for your, so now you were facing this problem and doing it in the context of geosteering. And what can you say about your approach that you ultimately used after you kind of saw all these things?
So I used what is known as Bayesian estimation.
Mm-hmm.
So what Bayesian estimation helped me to do is that I can define a bunch of random variables that represent all these things that we want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And once we get the sensor data, we can incorporate that data and actually refine those estimates. So the Bayesian estimation comes from what's known as the Bayes theorem, which actually is a probabilistic framework for performing evidential reasoning under uncertainty. So if you are uncertain about anything, you can represent it in terms of a probability density function, which we can call a belief.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get a measurement, you can update your belief, and there's a really cute,
that's
simple
the
formula.
Evidence.
That's the evidence. That's the evidence.
Yep. So you're unsure.
Mm-hmm.
You have some belief currently of maybe like what rock type you're in, let's say.
Yes.
Is that right? And
yes.
then you'll get a little bit of new evidence.
Yes.
And then you'll kind of update that belief.
Belief.
And you might have like the probability of this type of rock, probability of this type of rock.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, and the interesting thing is that it has a simple formula.
Mm-hmm.
The issues are mostly like a different ways of doing Bayesian estimation, just differing how you implement it. That's the only issue. But otherwise, it's a pretty straightforward way of looking at it. It's really theoretically rigorously we can actually perform this, and we can also incorporate all of these different bits of data that we get. That's the best part about it, is that the more information we get, the better our estimate gets, the less the uncertainty we have
the more confident you are in where you are.
Exactly. So.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, thank you for that. That's going to wrap up part one, and we'll come back for part two and get to know a little bit more about Dilshad.
Okay.